Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Art, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Allison Lee, one of the co-hosts of the channel and assistant professor of art history at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Today, I'm excited to be interviewing James Elkins and Erna Fiorentini about their new book, Visual Worlds, Looking, Images, Visual Disciplines, which was published by Oxford University Press in early 2020. Dr. Elkins is the E.C. Chadbourne Chair in the Department of Art History, Theory, and Criticism at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. His numerous books include The Object Stares Back on the Nature of Seeing, Master Narratives and Their Discontents, How to Use Your Eyes, What Painting Is, On Pictures and the Words That Fail Them, and my personal favorite, Pictures and Tears, A History of People Who Have Cried in Front of Paintings, and these are but a very select few. Dr. Fiorentini teaches at the Institute for the History of Art and Architecture of the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology in Germany. She is the recipient of numerous awards, including one from the German Research Foundation for Outstanding Scholarly Achievements, and she has edited two volumes, one entitled On Visualization, a Multicentric Critique Beyond Infographics, and the other called Observing Nature, Representing Experience, The Osmotic Dynamics of Romanticism, 1800 to 1850. The book they wrote, which we'll be discussing today, provides a full introduction to the visual world across all fields that theorize it. In contrast with typical visual culture texts, it looks beyond the arts, taking a comparative approach that considers quite a number of fields, including art history and theory, but also epistemology, ontology, vision science, neurology, cognitive cytology, law and advertising, medicine, warfare, and more. Visual Worlds is, to say the least, an astounding accomplishment. To say that it covers a wide range of topics is a terrible understatement. What Jim and Erna have achieved in this introductory textbook is remarkable. It provides thick discussions of different modes of looking, and the examples explored in the text range widely, from traditional artworks to the physics of candle flames to the visualization of neurons and well beyond. I'm very excited to discuss this book with them, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Jim Elkins and Erna Fiorentini, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice
Hello.
To be here.
Hi, nice to be here.
I'm so glad that we're able to have you today. Thanks for taking the time out. So I wonder if you might each begin by telling us a bit about yourself, where you were born, where you attended graduate school, how you kind of became interested in the visual worlds that you discuss in the book. Just give us both your background, some of your background, if you would.
Erna, who begins?
That's ladies first. Okay, just there. Because I'm the only one who's not American here in the round. So I'm Italian, actually, based in Germany at the moment. But I've been born in Italy, in Udine, somewhere between Venice and Trieste. There's the town where James Joyce lived short before he died, so somehow perhaps who is known in the U.S. And I studied in Trieste, actually. I went to school in Udine, and I've been studying in Trieste, beginning with the geological study, then which I pursued later in Bonn in Germany, which was at that time the German capital, as I began to study there. And I was actually a scientific-directed person from my family, and I pursued this career I made a PhD in Bonn as a geochemist in isotopic geochemistry. And I always interlaced this kind of interest, scientific interest, with interest in the humanities, in art, in architecture and archaeology. And it was in Bonn where I could interlace these two interests somehow. And I did pursue a PhD in art history and archaeology in Bonn at the same time, parallel to my geochemistry studies. So it was very interesting. I was under supervision of Gunther Schweikart, who was one of the scholars of early Renaissance, and Justus Müller-Ofstede is perhaps known somewhere in the U.S. as one of the leading, former leading scholars in Netherlands art of the 17th century, mostly Rembrandt. And Nicholas Himmelmann was one of the leading archaeologists at that time who was concerned with classical sculptures, and it was one of my mentors, if you want, because he was very very severe in his in his ideas about how to study archaeologists and how to be an archaeologist. So all those different directions were my points, my anchors during my studying time. And so I brought both of those directions in working of in archaeometry, which is something connecting the humanities and scientific directions. But I was somehow more interested in theoretical or methodical issues. So it was stronger than connecting the two directions of the humanities and the sciences in archaeometry. And in art history or the Bildwissenschaften, it was easier to accomplish this kind of methodical or theoretical commitment, if you want. And so I continued to work in art history and the Bildwissenschaft in Berlin at the Freie Universität together with Werner Busch, and together with Lauren Daston at the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science. And we made a lot of interesting projects together, connecting art and science somehow. And so I was able to connect these two roots, art and science, the humanities and epistemology, somehow in the history of science, connecting art history and the history of science. And so I went to the Humboldt Universität in Berlin. I was there in the department of Horst Bredekamp, I think it's a name who is also known in the U.S. and one of the first who was interested in this correlation between art and science, and this interaction of art and science, but also in the interaction of the humanities with science. And now, well, the KIT, the Karlsruhe Institute of Technologies, is a sort of congenial environment for me, or for my interdisciplinary work. And I think it's the best place to be at the moment. I have together in the department of with Inge Hinterwaldner, who is one of those young thinkers, I would say.
Yeah, she's great.
She's great, and she's really committed to disentanglement of art history, Bildwissenschaft, sciences, with a strong relation and interest in the new media and in computer imaging. And we are setting up sort of larger hub for visualization studies at currently at the KIT in Karlsruhe.
Jim, what about you? Background?
Yeah, so, well, that, I mean, I don't have an academic pedigree for interdisciplinarity that goes back in that way. I mean, I always owe listeners an apology or an excuse for not being phobic about science. And for me, so it's not so much the places that I studied as an adult, it's more or less my childhood that did that for me. So I grew up in Ithaca, New York. That's where Cornell is. And my father was a dentist. He was a Jewish boy from Brooklyn who escaped Brooklyn and made it out to the wilds of upstate New York, you know, only 5 hours from New York, but anyway, the wilds. And he got very engaged with his new environment. Our house was often completely filled with things that he had brought in from outdoors to try to identify, so that every surface was often filled with things like birds' nests that needed to be identified, the species of the bird needed to be identified, and mushrooms that were drying and waiting for some expert to come in and validate his attempt to identify them. And he collected and identified plants. We learned their Latin names, things like that. So I had a real kind of pseudo Ruskinian kind of natural 19th century style. I've never known how to characterize it exactly. It was really a bit out of time and place, but I had a very strange, unusual childhood in that regard. But basically then never felt alienated from science for that reason. And my sister's a scientist, and it's something that could have easily happened to me. So again, my studies in college were math and art history, and it was just a little chance that sent me to the art history side instead of math. So that's my way of saying that I've always been interested in these things, but it wasn't until our collaboration that I actually managed to do something about it. Mm. I mean, little bits and pieces of science, sure, of course, had gotten into things that I've written. But the thing in our book that made it through from my earliest childhood all the way into the book is a chapter that we have about halfway through the book called How to Look at a Sunset. And actually, our sources for that chapter are some really interesting German meteorologists from the 1920s. But my source is actually observing sunsets with that kind of amateur scientist eye when I was a kid, and trying to see what people had said about the clouds and the shapes of clouds and the ways that the atmosphere works and things like that from the point of view of a 10-year-old or something like that. But those kind of things have stayed with me. So, I mean, Aaron has been extremely good, you know, collaborator in many, many ways. But one of them is to make sure that I stay connected to the 21st century and not keep drifting back into some kind of, well, Ruskin past or something like that.
Well, I appreciate you both sharing this background. You know, I think partly I love doing these interviews because we don't get to hear so much about sort of, you know, childhood things like you were just describing.
Academics are never asked those questions.
I love asking them. And I think those who listen to the show and understand the format that we have really kind of enjoy getting a sense of those things, because scholars don't just become who we are suddenly, you know, in graduate school as the lightning hits our head. We are a product of, you know, our backgrounds in Italy, our training in Germany, our Ruskinian sort of upbringing in upstate New York and things like that. I'm glad, Jim, that you... Oh, please go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I think that there's actually a lot that you could go into here. You could do an entire conference on this, because I think a certain fairly high percentage of art historians are actually have as their formative moment their first trip to, say, Amsterdam when they were eight or something like that, you know, or for an American, like maybe their high school trip or something like that.
So
because
true.
That's what stays with you. And you know, it gets sometimes buried and forgotten, but you can read through to it sometimes in the work of some art historians.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll be looking forward to you organizing that conference. that sounds like definitely something
nice to try. Yeah.
Absolutely. Especially in this, you know, kind of virtual Zoom format where we feel, I think, a little bit more informal and we're in each other's homes and with students in their homes in these kind of odd ways. But I'm glad you mentioned the sunset chapter. That was definitely one of my favorites, though. Where we sort of dig into the book in terms of access points, you all certainly provide a lot. And I want to give our listeners a sense of what's in this book. But maybe as a build-up to that, I can just kind of ask, how did you come to write Visual Worlds? And how did you come to write it together? Did this start as an idea that one of you had that you brought to the other? Was it always collaborative? As I was reading it, I kept thinking, how did they do this? I mean, how did you do it both in terms of how you wrote it, but where did it come from as a book and as a textbook specifically?
You have been the first. You asked me. You begin.
I didn't actually even remember that I asked you.
It was very important. I'm very proud of it. So I was advertising this. Jim Atkins asked me to write a book with him. So,
I actually don't remember that. I think it might be useful for some of your listeners to know that this is a really successful collaboration that we have, and people in the humanities don't collaborate as often as they should. One of my dissertation supervisors, Barbara Stafford, used to say that the reason why people in the humanities never collaborate is because of the conceit that we all have that we know everything. And unless you can get past that, you can't actually collaborate. You have to actually admit that your knowledge is limited. So I'm not the one to fill in the details of this, but in terms of the way that the collaboration has worked, it's been pretty amazing. The entire unbelievable length of time it took, which was, I think, 6 years, more or less.
Wow.
It's been pretty amazing. And it could, I also want to give some like hope to people who are thinking of collaborating in the age of COVID. This was before COVID, of course, and finished before COVID, but it could have been during COVID because we only met face to face a couple of times. Hmm. And yet it was completely seamless. And these are all, multiply edited, multiply co-authored, many times co-authored and revised chapters. So that in terms of the way that the collaboration worked, I think it was great, really great. And then I can't remember exactly how it got started, but I could say that my own impetus to do this was, the way I like to say it is, for me anyway, it was ethical, because I feel like there's an awful lot of rhetoric about how, you know, our age is the most visual age ever. And we think through images and we understand the world through images and all the rest of that. And yet almost nobody tries to actually put together something that first year college students could look at to try to understand that. I feel like it was kind of an ethical obligation to at least try. And I think one of the reasons that very few people try this is simply because the visual world, as it were, whatever metaphor we want to use, is too enormous to think of compressing in the way that we did. So that makes the collaboration especially miraculous, because we managed to not chafe too much at those inevitable moments when things had to be compressed and to be as inclusive as possible at the same time.
Erna, do you want to say any more that Jim doesn't remember about how the book came about?
There are many points, because as to the time it took to write this book, we had 2 years in between, somewhere between 2012 and 2014, where we came to a sort of stop. Having written a lot already, And then I try to do some archaeology of our emails for my students, because we had one seminar about the book. And so I found some mails about thinking, should we continue at all? Because we had ideas, but somehow this kind of ethical impetus came to a stasis. I don't know why. And in somewhere, there was a stop. And I think it was just one mail. One time Jim, you wrote, I don't know exactly who, I should continue to write, we should continue to write. And I told you this kind of ethical answers, I think we should, because no other one would do it this way. And somehow that we have overcome this point of difficulty. But I don't know the genesis of this of this moment of difficulty in creation. I don't know exactly how what it was, but it was there.
I don't remember those emails, but for me anyway, the moments in which it seemed especially difficult to figure out how to go forward had to do with this issue of compression. So like in that chapter, How to Look at a Sunset, we have, like I said, a couple of wonderful sources from the 1920s. They were fun. They're interesting. There is some science. There's some meteorology involved. And you can describe it in the very short chapters that we had allowed ourselves by partitioning up the book, you know, and deciding how short the chapters had to be. We could do it. But then another chapter, which I imagine that we might touch on a bit, is how to look at a painting. Well, okay. That's several lifetimes worth of literature that no art historian has read all of. And how are you going to put that into the same like 3 or 4 or 5 pages of text? So there were moments like that when it seemed like compression itself had reached a breaking point. And then there were other moments also for me when we were perpetually reorganizing this book. There were moments when it did seem to me like, so one of the themes in the book is playing off the possibility of that there might be several subjects in this book against the idea that there is a single subject, visuality, which is what visual culture studies usually assumes, but playing that off against the fact that there are many specific kinds of seeing. And for me, at least, there were also moments when I thought, okay, it's really the latter that is the case. There are many different kinds of seeing, and they don't belong in one book. And they really can't be organized. There really is no central coherence there. And we have bitten off more than we can chew, et cetera, et cetera. Those are still, you know, inflection points in the text for sure. I think we've set it up so that every reader encountering the book can discover whether or not they wish to agree with us on these points of compression and of coherence.
Hmm. Well, but just thinking about the question of compression and what the reader may look for in the book is what it was one of our concern to reorganize these different matters in the book continuously, right? If you remember, Jim, as of our TOC, what in continuous change. Somehow, you also put it on your account, on your Facebook account, with a real time connection. So when we were changing anything in the TOC, it was at the same time published on the Facebook or on your website. I don't remember well. So it was a sort of sense of commitment in doing something someone could perhaps read at the same moment. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to reorganize. We have reorganized all the different chapters following different logics, I think. And it was one of the most, I was astonished about this way of working worked between us. Was it a sort of growing together while writing? Jim introduced this idea of online writing, right? Which is normal today, I suppose.
Well, I don't know, but I'd still do it, yeah.
Well, and I thought, well, how should we do? Each of us would write a chapter and then put them together. No, we worked continuously in the latter time on those chapter according to the logic of the TOC. And so it was really interesting to see that it's possible. I don't think it's possible for everyone. It was sort of congenial constellation between us in writing this way.
Erna, I'm glad you mentioned, Jim, working in this method, and I do want to jump in and give listeners more of a sense of the structure of the book. But Jim, before we move off of that, do you want to say a little bit about this writing live that you do? It's on your website, or is it also on Facebook?
We did a bit of that with this book. Yeah, the writing live idea is basically sometimes things are actually live. So we have a Google Doc, like for the table of contents for a while. That was actually live so that if we typed on it, someone could have been looking at that and then commenting. But other things are not quite live. I put a couple of drafts of chapters online before they were finished and invited comments. And I don't actually remember if any of those comments that I got online ended up in the book, but they certainly have done for my other projects. And in that case, I just thank the person who appeared from nowhere in social media and let them look at the text and the notice of them and their paraphrase of their words and make sure it's okay with them. And so it produces a little bump in the text for a reader, because then you come across a line like, reading an early draft of this, so-and-so suggested that, which is an unusual thing to read in a book, but it's the only way to be fair to acknowledge people.
Yeah,
but
very
in general,
unusual.
This book, I think we was helped along a lot by that kind of thing, mm-hmm. because the book has so many different disciplines that intersect it. And I think I know you want to actually tell people what's in the book, but I just also want to say before you do that, that one of the nice things about having finally actually finished this is that I feel like I could organize anything now. The existing readers of visual culture studies and visual studies and things like that are so simple by comparison, because you have there the issues of gender and identity and so on that drive those and the questions of social relations in art history and history are part of our project, but also our project has disciplines that usually just don't play a role at all in those kinds of introductions.
Yeah, you've segued perfectly for me to say just a little bit. I mean, I don't think it's possible to say all that's in this book. In fact, I kept coming up with different questions to ask you both about, you know, how would you describe with this book and what's in this book and what you cover? And I don't think it's possible, even just looking at the table of contents, a person couldn't really get a sense of, as I said in the introduction, how thick this book is with so many different ideas, so many different theories and themes and references to the work of other scholars and philosophers and theoreticians. Maybe I'll just say, just in terms of whetting the appetite of listeners to get this book, which I hope so many listening do, whether it's ordering it from the library or ordering a copy, you know, this just needs to be in as many students' hands and graduate students' hands, I think, as possible. But I will say, because I wasn't sure picking it up, how you handled it in terms of the co-authorship, that it is completely undecipherable who wrote what. And right. There was a bit of magic in terms of trying, because I'm especially familiar with Jim's writing in art history. And I already said a little bit about the number of books he's written. So I really thought I would be able to tell who wrote what. And I was not. The way you've written this is so tightly stitched together. There's only one moment in the introduction when you speak in your own voices and you make it clear why you're weaving it together in this way. And then poof, it is absolutely both of yours. And it's something to behold in that regard.
That's really, really nice of you to say. And now I want to interrupt you one more time to say that.
No,
that
please.
Little bit in the introduction. The notion there was we each allowed ourselves like a page to say the kinds of interest that we had, thinking that they would presumably be partly intermittently visible through the book. But basically only, and from my point of view, the main function of that was not to create a kind of a detective game for readers or anything like that. the basic idea was to disabuse readers of the idea that you could divide the book into threads in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I have guesses, but I really quickly stopped doing that and thought, why even am I trying to seek out who wrote what? It was interesting as a reader to grapple with that. So,
you know, I'm compulsively interrupting you now.
It's fine.
One of the negative models that I had in mind, I don't know, Erna, how much you were thinking of it, was the book Art Since 1900 as a negative model, because one of the things that happens in that book is it's supposed to be multiply authored with four authors in their case. Well, yeah. Four and a couple of largely uncredited women authors, by the way, but it had four main authors. Supposed to be, but if you look very carefully, they have several tables of contents spread through that book, and at the end of the chapter descriptions in those distributed tables of contents, they have initials, and that's okay. How you can actually tell who wrote the chapters, which I thought was very egocentric and coy and inappropriate and distracting all at once, and really should have been omitted. So sorry, go ahead.
So this sort of anthology, which our book is not. And I think I have learned a lot from this kind of working now and profiting from that, because I'm working in the same way with other people now in setting up an application for projects, working exactly as we did from my side, working together with the other people and pulling them in this kind of writing, not anthological but cooperative, which was my first experience with you, and it was extremely enriching.
I want to try as much as possible to give listeners a sense of, so the book is organized into seven overarching parts. And then within the overarching parts are individual chapters that I think are so perfectly bite-sized, in the sense that as dense as the material often is, and there are some parts where even I just thought, wow, I'm going to have to reread this. I mean, this just is moving through with such intensity, so many different theories, and it's all so fascinating. I mean, I found myself almost being embarrassed by how often I was writing in the margin, wow, so interesting. Oh my, fascinating. I mean, I felt like a student again, in terms of especially the more scientific material that, as Jim has pointed out, is so often unfamiliar to us art historians, or we know about it vaguely, but we don't know the scholarship, certainly. We haven't really dug into, you know, theories about animals, theories about how the military looks at images, all these elements. So all I can say is just to give a sense that it is very readable, as thick as it is. I keep using that word, but you really partitioned off the sections so that they are digestible and so that they are, I think, handleable by or manageable by students and by those who might teach from this book, which is, I think, where I'd like to go next. If I could ask you both about you, it's a recurring theme in this book, the transparency you have about the fact that this is a book that it is meant to be used in the classroom, that it is in some sense perhaps something that will replace or be a different option, let's say, the standard art appreciation textbooks or intro to visual culture, which, you know, I teach that in a very large size classroom with sometimes more than 100 students. And those textbooks do tend to be almost so facile, it's painful for students. I mean, that what is a line? What is a square? You know, this idea that it's kind of art history light or survey light, where you just kind of go through the major periods in art, showing them one or two examples, all of which are derived from the fine arts. You both are so strongly countering this notion that that is how we should teach these classes, where we have so many different kinds of students. I know in art appreciation, I have engineers of various kinds, petroleum engineers in Louisiana, electrical engineers. I've got nurses, I've got anthropology students. You know, I think they are the hungry audience that you are talking about when you talk about this book opening a conversation. So can you talk about how you envision this being used in the classroom, how much that ethical imperative you spoke of drove the way that you organized it and wrote it, the topics you cover? Just kind of take it in whatever direction you want.
Well, one aspect of that anyway, is the part of what this textbook is supposed to do is hopefully, fingers crossed, replace at least a small percentage of the freshman introduction to visual culture type of courses. The kind that Tom Mitchell, W.J.T. Mitchell, says that he was the first to teach, freshman classes on what's now called visual studies. Because in the sense that those classes take as their central gambit the notion that you can teach visuality, the politics and the history of kinds of visuality in such a way that you give the students a kind of toolbox to encounter any kind of visual practice. And it's basically a toolbox that has elements of ideological critique and social critique in it. And then when they go off in their separate directions, they can then apply these things to their fields. But what I had noticed about classes like that is that the students, as you say, that are in them who are going into different fields, a chemistry major, that kind of thing, that they end up not thinking about the material from that freshman class anymore once they get into their field, because it doesn't have the specificity that's necessary in order to have an actual utility, use value in a given discipline. So one of the seven sections of our book is about different disciplines. You mentioned how the military looks at images. That one in particular, I was thinking of as a response to some people in visual studies, like Nicholas Mirzoff, for example, has written a lot about military-industrial complex and images, but nothing with the specificity of different kinds of visual apparatuses that are used, for example, in missile nose cones and things like that. Nothing of that specificity that would allow a visual analysis to go forward, and it enables an ideological analysis. So the other chapters in that section, how doctors look at images, how lawyers look at images, how scientists look at images, how art historians look at images, that last one is meant to, to show that we're willing to, compress our own field in some sort of outlandish fashion. But the idea there for me was to propose specificities that are often linked to specific technologies. In the case of medicine, for example, the Da Vinci machine that allows remote operations on patients, that kind of thing, to introduce a kind of specificity that would keep these ideas alive as students go into their various fields.
Right, I think it's one of the strengths of the book that you can use it. You can use it as a toolbox for different sorts of teaching, different sorts of learning, right? It's interesting to see that the book, as probably people at other, have other expectations in the US than in Europe. And we have made one experiment now KIT and in Berlin with this connected seminar with the Humboldt University, trying to analyze the book as such and to use the book at the same moment. And so very much we have classes very mixed, people from the humanities and from medicine. You remember, Jim, perhaps this one radiologist in Berlin?
Yep.
And then one historian of science and so on. And they were asked to think about that book as a book for learning, because it's not usual in Europe to use textbook in not in art history mostly, and so it was an interesting experiment to see that the student needed a problem. So the problem of the book, vision and seeing and looking at the problem of the book through the book, and in those singular, particular chapters where they were able to dive in and be concerned with this topic, this one disciplinary topic. And then at the end, we tried to put them together and to search the link between these chapters. And so I think this was one of the ideas, not perhaps at the beginning, but the idea growing while writing, right? Then you can use the book in singular chapters. We say it at the beginning how to use this book, but you can put a problem for the book. I did it in the last seminar, and students were well accomplished this kind of duty, and say, okay, we learned something about the disciplines, about the militaries, how the militaries look at images, about how vision is defined in medicine, but we tried to bring all those chapters together under the big problem of vision or of looking or of how the visual disciplines are acting in themselves and with each other. So it was very interesting. I think it will be an interesting issue to observe how the book will be used in the US and how it will be used in Europe. Omar Nazim, you know him, Jim, in Regensburg. He's an historian of science, Omar Nazim. He's going to use, he's an historian of science. And he told me, well, it's wonderful to use this book for his sake, not only in the with the scientific chapters, but very much as a whole, where to navigate through. And it's interesting to see who is adopting this book in Europe.
Yeah,
which is probably in another way than in the US, because no one of those telling me about the book wants to use the book as a pre-graduate guide, but as a book, as a reading book, as a theory book.
Yeah, I mean, in the best of all possible worlds, it would have been possible to take a magic wand and wave it over the book and turn it into a graduate level monograph, because the people in, you know, postgraduate, graduate level don't look at textbooks as things that might be of interest. And this one is definitely a textbook because that was always and is its primary purpose. But it is absolutely and thoroughly very self-reflective and self-doubting, this textbook and that we've written. It's we have seven themes that we use to try to keep alive through the entire book. We list them at the beginning, we come back to them at the end, these seven themes. And the first one is we call the impossible textbook. And the second one, the variety of seeing, goes to that point of whether or not this is one subject or actually seeing is multiple subjects and shouldn't be united. So these are not settled questions. The book is therefore absolutely readable at the graduate level. It proposes these problems, philosophic problems, questions of interdisciplinarity and things. However, it has text boxes and things like that, which professionals are allergic to because they think that they're beyond them. And so that's why I say if we had a magic wand, it would have been nice to wave it over it and dissolve all the textbooks and produce another book, which would have been had the exact same content, but would have looked like a serious monograph and would have definitely engaged at the graduate level. And in terms of like the intended public, I think our editors at Oxford were always more sanguine, at least than I was, about how much this would be adopted in the States. These textbooks undergo a really, really exhausting vetting. And this one went out in the form of questionnaires to a number of instructors, you know, would you adopt a book like this? And they got enough positive responses to fund us and, you know, so we could write the book. But I really have my doubts because I still picture now the way I did, you know, 7 years ago. I still imagine a potential textbook adopter who teaches a freshman class in visuality or visual culture artistry. I imagine them at the College Art Association conference, looking at it, opening it, and to a page that shows some sort of like a graph, a picture of neurons, and think, oh my God, I'm never going to teach this. Right? Close the book and walk away. Right? This is the way I still imagine it.
I think it is daunting to some extent, though I do think maybe you're overestimating how daunting it is to open to one of those pages and see, you're right, you know, from a teaching perspective, it's always going to be, you want to be the expert in the room. I mean, you want to feel like what you are about to lecture or discuss with your students is something that you're some sort of authority on. And this book is so obviously the the summation of a lifetime on two people's lifetimes of scholarship and reading. And, you know, as you were just talking, both of you now, and thinking through how this might be used in the classroom and your hopes for it and the differences pedagogically between Europe and America, I couldn't help but think that maybe what I was trying to latch onto the whole time I was reading it as a professor who hopes for books like this. I mean, who really looks out for what is the future of the field and what role will I play in bringing in lawyers and criminal justice majors and engineers and scientists who I think you're right, need to understand the density of the principles of visuality in especially our world, especially as much as that's a cliche. But I almost think this would be a great book to be on every PhD comprehensive exam reading list, because they're really, nice, you know, as awful as that would be to have your advisor put that this on your list and say, well, you need to read this. It brings some sort of awareness to all of these different theories and things that I think graduate students in especially art history, but other fields would need to be aware of. It's almost like we need to be daunted by the amount that we're not taking in. And this book introduces you to the lifetime you're going to have to spend to truly understand what the needs of our students are and maybe what the future of the field might look like. So I don't know if either.
Why didn't we get? We should have gotten Allison to write something for the back cover.
Oh, Jim, I'm not a big enough deal to. But my name on the back of the book wouldn't help sell it, unfortunately, yet. But you know, I maybe the reason I do this podcast and read books like this and want to talk to scholars like you is because I do want to introduce the world to a much larger extent, and podcasts I think are one of these mediums to the amazing work that scholars like you two are doing we might not otherwise be on the radar of people who have deep interests in visual culture and visuality and visual worlds. I mean, all the different ways that you talk about that you can kind of describe the subject in this book.
I think. Sorry, can I add something to that?
Please do.
I'm not managing your time, so I'm not really sure. But
I've got it. Don't worry. I'm keeping an eye.
Okay, just to add one thing to that, I think we're both very aware of the fact that even though art history has a broad reach, we are in one corner of the quad of the university, as it were. It's a sad thing about universities in the last 100 years or so that you can say you got a degree from such and such a university when actually you probably just got a degree in what was taught in one building, in one corner of the quad, in one part of campus. And that goes for art history and all the other humanities as well, and social sciences and so on. And we end up this textbook, our part seven, I think would probably be a surprise to everybody, including the scientists who happen to pick up the book, because the last part of it is actually about writing. And it seems to me that one of the first most interesting barriers of provincialism to break down for art history is the barrier that is often exists, invisible one, of course, between the art history department and the literature department, the comparative literature department, the English department, the German department, and so on. Because there's such a rich tradition in those departments of reading text that we in art history are completely oblivious of. All we do is tell our students to write clearly, and that's so rudimentary. That's something Cicero didn't even do.
Right? Really sad, yeah.
It is very sad.
But you see, there is a difference between Europe and the US, because in the university I have been working in this kind of separation is not given, and so there are many cooperation between literary departments and art history, but it doesn't mean that the students are writing better. So
exactly.
Anyway, so the literary departments are concerned with reading more than with writing, right? So it's very interesting to see, but it's a good point you brought up, Jim, because it remembers me of another point I wanted to bring up, which is this the question of method. And I think that the book is, as it was my concern, to bring something to think about how our method as art historian, as an historian of science, as a scientist is about, right? And this methodical idea and this methodical thread in the book is, I think, very important. It's very important because this kind of comparison between different disciplines, but with different ways of thinking in different disciplines, most of all in the chapter about writing, is thinking about why we are doing all that. And what's the final question in our seminar last time to ask, okay, now you're all, or rather all, art historian, what do you think about your discipline now, after having tried to work with this book? And I think it's an important point. If you say, okay, we have a gap between literary department and art history, so it's my hope that the book could bring up more thinking about what we are doing as art historian, as art historian of science, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to give one another particular example. Another of the book's seven themes is called Thickets of Representation. It's a term that I take from a historian of biology, William Wimsatt, who used to teach at University of Chicago. He studied things like the diagrams that scientists make of genes, of DNA, and so on, that we've all been seeing a ton of in the last year because of the COVID virus. And he made the point that certain structures are too complex to be shown with a single image. And so you need several different kinds of representation, different visualizations, and also different imaging techniques made with different kinds of microscopes, that kind of thing. And you need them all, and you can't put them together into a single image. And that turns out to be very widespread in science. We have several examples in the book from different fields, and yet completely unknown to art history. Yes. And I would almost like to say those practices outnumber the kind of things you see in art history, that the closest you get in art history is, you know, when a painter leaves also a few sketches, and you could study the sketches along with the painting, and you can then make the case that you need to know the sketches and the painting in order to get the full idea. That would be an analogy, but it's very limited. Most of the time, it's the Mona Lisa that speaks for the Mona Lisa, and it's the be-all and end-all of that of itself. And there's a kind of essentialism with that, and a kind of simplification. So, it's a little bit like discovering new worlds everywhere. This brave new world of multiple visualizations of objects that can't be shown in a single picture. And one last example of something that's about interdisciplinarity. We have a section in the book also about animal vision. And for some people, I have a colleague who's one of them. For some people, that's just too little, too late. Like, we need to give up the human, go on to the post-human. We should have started with animals. We could talk about animal vision, or for that matter, artificial intelligence and machine vision. We should start with prosthetics and move away from the human and all the rest of that. Well, we didn't do that, but it's an open door. So wanted to make sure again that some specifics were in the book, not just the idea that you could start to think about animal vision, but some specifics of particular ways that some animal communities, exist by virtue of vision, which immediately opens out reveals the kind of simplicity of the formulas that we love to use, like the Jacques Lacan's, vision, which is with, seeing is always being seen and so on. But, if you're a fish that lives 1,000 feet down in the ocean, and there are several dozen other fish with different kinds of eyes, then life suddenly gets much, much more complicated. So just to leave doors open so that people can, or windows, so people can look through them and see what's out there, I think was the main strategy in a lot of that.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that particular chapter on animal seeing. I wanted to make sure that we somehow talked about that in the midst of all this. And I'm glad you talked about that in terms of this idea of that this book is partly about discovering new worlds, and that animal seeing in particular allows us to think about new worlds of visuality that I agree we should have long ago thought about this and theorized this. It should be a part of our thinking, as should machine vision or machine learning and things like that. I thought it might be a fun sort of way to begin moving towards a conclusion. Maybe, you know, we have about 10 minutes left to ask you both what your, maybe this is an unfair question, but what your favorite chapter is in retrospect, whether to write it, it was super fun, to research it, it was super fun, or it's just one that continues to just be sort of stuck in your mind. I have certain ones that have become my favorite. The animal vision chapter, certainly. It's like I can't stop thinking about it. The Jim and Erna, whoever wrote it, I won't ask, talk about the vision or the visual systems that the mantis shrimp has. And that blew my mind, the possibility that the colors that bees see are simply unimaginable to us.
For some people, like that colleague I was just mentioning, that stuff is so old hat. Oh yes.
Well, I guess maybe I'm embarrassing myself by saying how moved I was by that. I also really enjoyed there's a chapter called Looking at the Inside of Your Own Eyes that has a series of kind of experiments contained within it. You know, try this and do this with your eyeball and look, now you can see this. And I can't stop thinking about it. I think this book planted little seeds in my mind, and I imagine it will do that to many students and just general readers who pick it up.
Did you make the experiments yourself? So I tried with my students. I tried with my students.
What happened? I'm ashamed to admit this too, but something about it scared me. Maybe as an art historian, my greatest fear is of losing my sight, or I would never want to become the Beethoven of art history. So I'm very careful with my eyes and light.
But maybe what's scary about that kind of thing in the end is that things, the phenomenon in this case that are actually from the inside of your eye might turn out to be more interesting than the Mona Lisa. That's the really scary thing.
I'm terrified. I don't want to discover that. Yeah.
But it's beautiful, I think, about this one chapter that the students can experiment this kind of self-introspection, which has a so long historical background, right? As this idea of after images and so on, and then you can bring them to be interested in to get interested in this kind of historical background by using these self experiments, so to speak, right?
So Erna, which was your favorite to write? Can I press you both, or which is the is there a single chapter that kind of lingers?
I do have a favorite chapter since you asked.
Oh, okay. Jim's ready.
This would be, and this may surprise you, Erna, because we never talked about it this way, like favorite chapters. Okay. But my favorite is the last one. So the last chapter, which we call Writing Through Images, it's the last of three chapters on writing. It's about writers, 20th century writers, the ones that we chose, who have an investment in images and paintings, and in some cases they're writing about paintings and other images. In some cases they're using them, like Sebald, the novelist who put photographs in his novels. But it's very entangled, this use, because we're not in that chapter just talking about people who have actual photographs in their books, like Sebald, but we're talking about the interweaving of the visual and the verbal. And the last section of the last chapter is on Proust, who has lots and lots of real paintings that he mentions in his novel. And in fact, there's a big, expensive, overpriced coffee table book called something like Proust in Images, where someone went and photographed all the original paintings that Proust was doing. But anyway, the reason why that's my favorite is because you would never expect to end up there if you open a book called Visual Worlds and you see that it has to do with art history and also science and things. You would never expect to end up in that spot. I think it's absolutely wonderful that we ended up there, because that's the least predictable place to end up. Even if you include the inside of your own eye or thinking about how a mantis shrimp sees, because those things are, as Erna said, they have histories. the animal vision is a current interest, but the idea of entoptic phenomena, as they're called, things that, you know, things you think you see from the inside of your eye, has a very long history. But this subject doesn't seem, I think, immediately to be connected. It's connectable. You know, we connected it.
Exactly.
But so it's like you end in a very unexpected place. That's why I like that one.
Yeah, fascinating. What about you, Erna?
Yeah, well, I also do like this one, very last chapter, because it was a sort of quintessence of this working between Jim and me. He was interested in experimental writing. I was interested in how writers were looking, and I think this chapter has grown as the very top of our collaboration. But I like the introduction. I love the introduction because it's a methodical path to follow, and I think I hope that our students are learning from the introduction and getting curious somehow.
And by the way, don't forget, you should absolutely. Not forget, don't forget to ask us our least favorite chapter. I would like to answer that.
Now I feel like this question was a little bit faster. I genuinely want to know, and as a human being, you know, not necessarily as a scholar, and when I'm preparing for these interviews, I try to think, you know, what kinds of questions do just people want to ask you and wish they could? I mean, I have you on the line, so I have a responsibility beyond myself. Dare I follow through it and ask you, which is your least favorite? I never even thought to denigrate any of the chapters.
My own least favorite chapter is, it's in part two. It's chapter five, called Staring and Peering, Glimpsing and Glancing. Because we spent a long time pondering whether or not the gaze, as in the theory of the gaze, should be the model, the paradigm for looking in general, or should we use looking in the sense that Lacan and others do, and what should be our master metaphor, as they used to say. And we were both interested in specific kinds of seeing, so we ended up compressing those interests into this chapter. And I still think that's a very unsatisfactory chapter. I wouldn't take it out of the book. I mean, I really think as a problem, it needs to be there. But there are ways that you could make the case that peering should be as important as gazing, and that should have its own conferences in its own book. And the farther you go down toward that road, the more you disintegrate our project into a number of different separable subjects. So that chapter itself is a series of like shards and fragments pushed together into a chapter.
Yes, but it's very important because it is the counterpart of the other chapter called Styles of Looking, right? Which is one of those, my student had said, one of those new concepts which has not been there before. What is this kind of styles of looking we defined in this the next part after the kinds of looking? And so that difference is very important. So these kind of fragments are so important to think about what these kinds of looking are. And so then this brings me to the one chapter I don't like so much because it's very didactical, which is the part about the gaze, in fact.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But it's important to have it there.
Everyone expects it, yeah. This distinction between kinds of looking and styles of looking, we wish that we could have thought of something that was a better mnemonic, but was it kinds of looking in this context, that where we're talking now, means things like peering and glancing, glimpsing if they're different from staring and so on. Styles means, in our book, different ways of looking when you apply to different kinds of things. Like you're looking at a sunset, there's a style of looking at a sunset. But, you know, just English doesn't have the words that have the bite that we would need to really make that memorable. But under the heading of styles of looking, we have a chapter, for example, looking at advertisements. Because you certainly, there's a different form of looking. It's another not so memorable way of putting it that applies to advertisements that don't apply to sunsets and so on. So it's an important issue.
It's interesting to hear you both say that, and I should admit that looking at advertisements was also one of my favorites. You have a text box in that chapter about eye tracking and dwell time, which now has totally messed up my ability to teach, because all I'm thinking about is, where are they looking? Are they looking the same place I'm looking? How long are they looking there? It seems so much like something I should have known before. And
because advertisers who manipulate our consciousness know it very well.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the perfect spot for that text box to be. So I don't have any qualms about reading those. So maybe I haven't reached the point in my scholarly life where I think I'm beyond reading the text box. Each one was just such a juicy morsel. And I'll admit that the chapter Staring and Peering, Glimpsing and Glancing had one of my most frustrated with you both moments. It's a silly thing, but maybe I'll just putting teasers out for listeners to pick up this book. But you talk in that chapter about this robotic exploration of the narrow tunnels inside the Great Pyramid of, I don't know if I'm saying it right, Cheops maybe in Khufu. And you choose not to reproduce, once they got the robotic arm with the camera all the way inside this space that hasn't been seen in 4,500 years, which of course I'm like, I'm going to turn the page, I can't wait to see it. And you say, we're not going to reproduce it. And I totally understood why you made such a succinct, good case for, we're not going to do it. And I don't think I'll ever be able to bring myself to Google it, though I know it's right there. I could just Google it, I imagine it, and be able to see inside there. But I don't know, you both just made so many fascinating choices in this book that are just as fun, as Erna was saying, to kind of analyze the book, as a piece of writing, as to absorb the information within it. Well, I've taken up a lot of your time. I do want to ask you the kind of traditional last question.
She wants to ask us what the camera saw.
No, I'm not. After my initial frustration, I've resigned myself that this is an image I'm never going to see. I don't.
No,
there's a map.
Contract. It says in our contract we can't answer that.
Oh, really? Well, I desperately want to ask you both what you're working on now or next. If you could just briefly say what projects have entered your sphere and what the public who have become interested in your work can look forward to. Erna, do you want to go first here at the end as we start?
It's not very much, because the one book you mentioned, the visualization beyond infographic, is it just to appear? So it's just forthcoming. So it's the next I will finish. But I'm looking for another form of looking, trying to set up a theory of landscape photography, in the sense of how we look at landscape through the medium of photography, and something like a sort of instrumental history of vision, with the idea there are periods which can be described with optical drawing devices, which are sort of metaphor for a certain period of seeing in art and in science and related to images. Mm. And the other two projects I'm looking for at the moment.
Okay. Keep an eye out. Jim, what about you?
Yeah, this is not actually a project yet, but it's an appropriate thing to mention at the end here, because I've got one toe in the water of another Oxford Press textbook project. This one is just at the stage of just talking. I just have a group of people I'm talking to, talking with about it. But the idea would be to write a next generation world art history textbook, which would take other cultures seriously instead of presenting them, instead of using words from Greek and Latin roots like space and time. We would use as much as possible words from other cultures, not translated. And to present other cultures in their own words. It's an extension of something we tried in this book, where we have a couple of words that are untranslated, which we tried, non-European terms we call them, which we put in a couple of places just because I didn't want to make an entirely monolingual textbook, yet another European, exclusively European textbook. So this project is really just in the talking stages, and if it works, it might be as difficult to sell as this textbook of Erna's in mind, in the sense that it really would create completely alien histories, alien in the sense of unrecognizable. Your history, the chapters on Japan and China and so on in this book would have a completely different vocabulary and would look at different objects than people expect. So don't know what will happen to that, but that's what's going on at the moment.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that at the end, too. We never did talk about the way that you have woven that idea. It pops up, you know, throughout the book in terms of these, as you call them, non-European terms for the way that that might open up the field in new ways. So those, they both, all the things you're working on just sound like great projects. I really enjoyed talking to both of you about your book today. I think it stands to make a significant contribution to discourses surrounding visuality, both in art history and really well beyond it. My name is Allison Lee, and you've been listening to New Books in Art, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I've been talking to James Elkins and Erna Fiorentini about their new book, Visual Worlds: Looking, Images, Visual Disciplines. Thanks so much for listening.